Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be taking up a topic that we certainly have discussed before on the program, and that is immigration. This country was profoundly changed by a wave of immigration that peaked early in the last century, and we have come to celebrate those newcomers, to honor their struggle to become Americans. Today, immigration is once again transforming this country, but there are many Americans who are not welcoming the change. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Nancy Foner. She's professor of sociology at Hunter College and the Graduate Center, City University of New York, and her main area of interest is immigration. She's particularly interested in comparing immigration today with earlier periods in the United States. She will be here in Champaign-Urbana next week to take part in an initiative sponsored by the Center for Advanced Study on the U of I campus, looking at the history and policy of immigration. And she'll be giving a talk on the 7th on the subject, What's New About the New Immigrants? This takes place in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. That's on South Gregory in Urbana. That's Tuesday of next week, and I'm sure that anyone interested in attending should feel welcome. She's also authored a number of books dealing with these subjects, and let me mention just a couple of titles. From Ellis Island to JFK, New York's Two Great Waves of Immigration. That's published by the Yale University Press in 2000. Not Just Black and White, Historical and Contemporary Perspectives on Immigration, Race, and Ethnicity in the United States. That from 2004. And then from 2005, In a New Land, A Comparative View of Immigration, published by the New York University Press in 2005. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. If you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call, use that number. We'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. So if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or maybe you any place else in the United States, if you're listening on the Internet, you can also use that number. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are certainly welcome. All we ask of people is that they just try to be brief so we can make a lot of room for as many callers as possible. Professor Foner, hello.
Hello. Delighted to be here.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly do appreciate it. Just, you know, I think that it's true in the history of the United States, in migration has always been important. Without it, we wouldn't be here. But also, when people think about the idea of America as being a nation of immigrants, think about important waves of people and what they meant to the United States, I'm sure that people's benchmark will be this time in America from sort of the late 1800s to about 1920, when significant numbers of people came from Europe, most of them, helped to sort of get us into this frame of mind that says, yes, that's what America is all about. It's about immigrants. That's where the strength of the country comes from, and so forth and so on, to the point where it's built into something I think in your writing have suggested has come to almost mythic status, that this time these people. So just to start, let's talk about, well, numbers. How many people are we talking about?
Well, in terms of numbers, the numbers today are larger than really ever before. There, at the latest count, there are 38 million immigrants in the United States, which is huge. Just to give some comparison, in 1910, which was after, you know, several decades of pretty heavy immigration, the immigrant population was 14 million, and actually the highest before that, before 2006, was, just to give you some more figures, was in 1930 when it was 14 million. So really this 38 million figure now is huge in terms of absolute numbers. But we also have to look at the percentage, because obviously America is a much bigger country today, you know, more than 300 million people than it was at the beginning of the 20th century. And in fact, in 1910, 15% of the population in the United States were foreign-born or immigrant, and today the population is just inching up. It's just inching up to 13%. So it was a percentage of immigrants in the United States was actually higher at the beginning of the 20th century than it is today. But the absolute numbers are really very huge.
Mm-hmm. And when you another thing that's sort of an important point of comparison, at least if we're talking about then and now, is where did these people come from?
Well, there's a huge, another enormous difference between that. I mean, 100 years ago in this, what I often talk about as the last great wave of immigration, which was really between about 1880, 1890, and 1920, in that wave, almost 95% of the immigrants were European. Now that it's so virtually all of them. I mean, there were some Chinese, there were some Mexicans who came, there were some West Indians in small numbers, but overwhelmingly, 94%. Now that is, you know, overwhelmingly European immigration. Today, European immigrants in the United States are 13% of the total. Most of the immigrants are from Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean, and actually 55% are from Latin America and the Caribbean. So there's been an enormous difference. I mean, we shouldn't think that Europeans are not coming anymore. They are. But the number and the proportion, really we're talking about the proportion, is much lower, obviously, than in the past. The present immigration, we can safely say, is overwhelmingly from Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean.
Today, certainly a lot of the controversy about immigration, and I guess we should be clear that the controversy is really about illegal immigration, not legal immigration. And in fact, there may be some important questions asked about legal immigration as well, and that's a subject worthy, I'm sure, of study. But the controversy surrounds illegal immigration and the points that of who these people are, what they bring with them in terms of skills and resources, what's their commitment to the United States, how quickly do they assimilate, and so forth. And one then sets that next to the kinds of things that people think they know about the experience of this previous wave of immigrants and what they brought with them and their commitment to America and how quickly they assimilated and how difficult it was and whether America embraced them or not. Mm-hmm. And so we have two very different storylines. And I suppose the important question is, well, how do you compare those two immigrant experiences? And were they really very different? Or were they actually more alike than now we like to believe?
Oh, that's a very, you ask many complicated, there are so many different parts of
I'm
your
so
question,
sorry.
I don't
this
even know where
this
to
is
start.
One of my great flaws as an interviewer.
Well, let me start by just, if we're going to, just to get the conversation going. First, let's just so people have an idea out there and listening, because there is, I think you're right, absolutely. I think today, Americans often say, well, immigrants are great, but not illegals. And, the focus is on undocumented immigrants. And, of course, there are large numbers of undocumented immigrants in the United States today, something that's happened really. I mean, the numbers have just shot up in the last decade or so, and there are somewhat almost, it's 12 million, the estimate recently was just published in the papers today. The estimate is about 12 million undocumented immigrants in the United States today. So that's a very significant number. Now, 100 years ago, in this last great wave of immigration, if we're talking about European immigrants, who we've just spoken about were the overwhelming majority, there were really hardly any European immigrants who were illegal. There, up until the 1920s, there were no numerical limits on European immigration. There were no immigrant visas that you had to get to enter the United States for Europeans. And so, really, all you had to do is get on the boat. And that was actually, you had to pass inspection to get on the boat. So that was actually the big hurdle. You had to pass inspection in Europe because if you didn't, the steamship companies did the inspections. They had an interest in doing that because if you got to Ellis Island and you didn't pass through the inspections, they had to pay for your passage back to Europe. So they instituted these inspections. So you needed to get on the boat. And then once you got on the boat, you were likely to get through Ellis Island. There's kind of a myth that a lot of people got turned away, but that's not true. Only 1% of the 25 million immigrants who landed at Ellis Island before World War I were excluded. So There were really hardly any illegal European immigrants. Just to make clear, there were bars on Asian immigration from 1882. There was a Chinese Exclusion Act. They were barred, and so there were some Asian immigrants who were coming in, I guess, in not entirely legal ways, or staying on in not entirely legal ways, but. If we're talking about, by and large, it wasn't not an issue 100 years ago, and it is a huge issue in the United States today. So that's just sort of baseline here about, the unauthorized immigrants. The other questions you ask are about assimilation, commitment, embracing America. I don't even know. It's hard to focus this on illegal versus on legal immigrants. Mm-hmm. I think that let me just talk about myths in terms of the past, so we can just start out that way. When immigrants came 100 years ago, they were not welcomed with open arms. People were very hostile to new immigrants. There was a lot of antipathy to them. In fact, it was felt that they were not committed to America. And one of the things that was noted and that people resented was their sending money home. It was said that they were plundering America. They didn't come here. They weren't committed. There was actually a concern that they were not becoming citizens, that they didn't want to embrace America. Italians and Jews, for example, were thought of not as fully white as two University of Illinois professors, David Roediger and James Barrett, talk about them as in between peoples, in between white and black. They were disdained. It was thought that actually they could never assimilate. It was felt that Jews and Italians could never be fully American. That they were polluting America's Nordic and Anglo-Saxon stock. So actually, they were just to put this in perspective, and this had nothing to do with their legal status, because they were legal, that wasn't even an issue. They were legitimately in the United States. But there was tremendous prejudice against them, and there were movements to restrict immigration. Those were very large movements in the early part of the 20th century. There were laws passed. In fact, several presidents vetoed them. They passed Congress to cut off immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe. And the justification often was this racial justification, that they were polluting America and they were forever changing America for the worse, and they had to stop. And actually, in the 1920s, Congress, and this was enacted, there were restrictions placed on immigration, and national origins quotas came into being, and which were designed and did restrict immigration very greatly from Eastern and Southern Europe. So, lest we romanticize the past, we should keep in mind that, America, people look back to immigration of the earlier eras with great fondness, but at the time, there's often a lot of resentment.
Yeah.
I don't know how we get into the present. I think there's obviously a lot of resentment in many parts of the country and hostility, an uneasiness about undocumented immigrants in particular. But I think about many other immigrants, Latino immigrants, face particular hostility in many parts of the country because they're often stereotyped as undocumented. And that they are not going to be committed to America, that they don't want to assimilate. Well, for one thing, many do come here and just want to work and go back home. I mean, that is true of many Mexican immigrants, and a very large proportion of undocumented immigrants are Mexican. They would actually just like to come and work and then go home. One of the paradoxes of the recent stepped-up enforcement at the border is it's actually made it more difficult for them to get home and come back again. And so actually that's lengthened their stay because crossing the border has become more dangerous and expensive and difficult. Many of them actually today aren't planning to come. But those who continue to stay here and work here, and of course who have children and their children are American citizens who are born here, undoubtedly become more committed to America, become more American in their ways, and certainly their children, as children of immigrants in the past, become much more fully American.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Nancy Foner. She is a distinguished professor of sociology at Hunter College and the Graduate Center, City University of New York, and she's very interested in immigration, particularly in comparing immigration today with earlier periods in the United States. She'll be on the campus of the University of Illinois next week to talk on this very subject, and we're here and open to questions, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
I think one of the things, if I could add something, because I think this is another point of contention about immigrants today, is that it's often said that today's immigrants and their children don't learn English and that this wasn't true in the past. You know, In fact, in New York, I've given many talks about my book, and a hand will go up in the audience and someone will say, but my grandparents, they knew English, you know, and today's immigrants don't. Well, you know, that's not true. In fact, the similarities with the past really stand out when it comes to language. The immigrant generation who arrive as adults make some progress to learning English, and the longer they're in the United States, the better they speak English, the more likely they are to speak English, but they're often more comfortable and fluent in their native languages. The children of immigrants who were born here are very often bilingual. We know that from studies today, certainly, that and that's true even in parts of the United States where Spanish is widely spoken and where there's a lot of Spanish media. Just to give data I have here from a recent study, 88% of second-generation Latinos 18 and older spoke English very well. And then by the third generation, what we find is a dominant pattern of monolingual English. Almost all of the Asian third generation speak only English, and about two-thirds of the Mexican third generation speak only English. So, you know, this is not what people think, right? I think another thing, again, just to add, and this is a difference from the last time. I mentioned before that in the 1920s there was restrictive immigration legislation, and then that was followed by the Great Depression and World War II. As a result, there was not a replenishment. There wasn't continued immigration of these Eastern and Southern European groups that had come in earlier in the century. So that the children of immigrants were growing up and moving into adulthood at a time when there were no fresh immigrants coming into their neighborhoods. The immigration had pretty much stopped. That's not true today. There's continued immigration. In fact, the figure I have here, it's actually quite astounding. More than half of the immigrants in the United States in 2006 came since 1990. So that's just a lot of recent immigrants who are coming. And remember, they're coming in all different ages. So that many children of immigrants who were born in the U.S. are going to school with children their age who came, you know, last week. And that makes a difference, I think, in you know, what people hear. And they see all these different groups, and so they think, oh, they're not learning English. Because what they may be seeing is a person who was only here a few weeks or months or years, and not realizing that the person who was born here to immigrant parents is speaking English, you know, very well.
This story, the immigrant story, the one that we tell about the fact that people came here seeking a better life, the country welcomed them because somehow we recognized that we could draw on their strength and their interest in working hard, and that these people came and they settled down and they plunged right in and they learned English and they pulled themselves up by their bootstraps and they became Americans and they assimilated very quickly and rapidly. All that kind of thing. And as you say, if you look at the actual experience of these people, we see that it was really very different from that. When did that conventional immigrant narrative get started?
Well, interestingly, I think it really took hold in this whole notion of America as being a nation of immigrants when immigration had stopped from those areas in the 50s, really, and, you know, in the 40s, after World War II. It took a while before that image took hold. So I think it wasn't, as I said, it wasn't during the immigration. It was after the immigration had stopped. Now, again, the difference today is that the immigration hasn't stopped, you know, and I don't know, there doesn't seem to be. We can talk about how the economy will affect that. that, but it's not going to stop. And I doubt there's going to be, of course, we never know what will happen, but I doubt there'll be the same kind of draconian legislation passed as happened in the 1920s.
Just to talk about numbers for a moment here, and I'm interested in your reaction to something, a report that seems just to have come out pretty recently from the Pew Hispanic Center, looking at numbers, and their conclusion was that in this past spring, as of March, there were 11.9 million unauthorized immigrants in the U.S., and that apparently, according to the report, the size of the unauthorized population appears to have been declining over the past year or so. Now, because we're dealing with some very big numbers, they say what we're talking about here is not statistically significant, although it seems to me that if you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people, that's noteworthy, although, you know, you can argue about how much that means. But there does seem to be some balancing in fact, the inflow of immigrants who are undocumented has actually fallen below that of immigrants who are legal permanent residents. And so you wonder, well, okay, what does that mean? Does that mean anything? Does it say something about what's happening with the economy? Does it say something about our being tougher on people who are undocumented? Or is it significant or is it not?
Well, I guess we're going to have to wait to see what the trend, you know, how it works out over time, you know, over the next few years to really know. But, you know, the suggestions are, or speculations to try to understand this, is that it's both the economy and beefed up in enforcement, they're both at work. But in terms of the decline in the number of undocumented who were coming to the U.S., I think the big question is really the economy right now, you know, which is something I've been asked a lot, you know, living in New York, the heart of which is going to be very badly hit by this. And so, you know, a big question, and New York has 3 million immigrants, which is, again, rather enormous, and 37% of New York City's population is foreign-born. And so this is a very important issue in New York City. And the question is, you know, what's going to happen as Wall Street is in crisis and the city is looking forward to some very hard times? Are immigrants who have been coming into the city at a rate of almost 100,000 a year, is that going to fall off? And I would suspect it may fall off. Yes, I would think it may fall off. On the other hand, immigrants have in the past kept coming during times of economic downturn, in part because things are even worse in the places where they're living. And if an economic downturn affects the United States adversely, I can be sure that in Latin America and the Caribbean, it's also going to be very hardly, you know, hard hit, so that people may be willing to take a chance to come here, particularly if they have friends and relatives who will put them up and maybe help them try to get a job. Now, maybe they'll return if they can't get work, you know, so I don't know how much it will be affected. The other concern, and this is a concern of the sending countries today, is that remittances may fall off. I mean, there's some evidence of that already, that Latin American immigrants in the United States are sending back less than they had been. And so, you know, if the economy tanks here and immigrants are having a hard time managing, you know, one of the things that they might do is cut back on what they're sending home. And that's, of course, of great concern to countries like Mexico and actually throughout the Caribbean, where just a large, you know, remittances are a very key aspect of their economies.
We are on a midpoint here of this conversation on Focus 580. Our guest is Nancy Foner. She is Distinguished Professor of Sociology at Hunter College and the Graduate Center at City University of New York. She's interested in immigration, particularly in comparing the experience of immigrants and immigration today with earlier periods in the United States. She's going to be here on the campus of the University of Illinois next week and will give a talk on Tuesday. The title is What's New About the New Immigrants? This is part of an initiative of the Center for Advanced Study looking at the history and policy of immigration. And this will be at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on October 7th, so that's next Tuesday, in the Knight Auditorium, the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. And I'm sure anybody who is interested in attending, hearing what she has to say, should feel welcome. Questions welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm really interested in your comment that this last wave of immigration, the one that started in the late 19th and went into the early 20th century, the fact that a major problem came along, the Depression came along, and really stopped that. Mm-hmm. And that, I'm sure what that
well,
did...
Well, don't forget restrictive legislation.
Well, that too. So in there were a couple of things that brought an end to that. And so that meant that that gave the country a little breathing space and allowed for the absorption of these people, some time to go along, some time for them to get settled in. I wonder if today we're thinking that the levels of immigration that probably things that's going to be a constant somehow. So there's never going to be that kind of space. Do you think in fact that's what's likely to happen?
Well, I think that at least the evidence so far is that, I think you have minimized the extent to which restrictive legislation was involved. I mean, yes, the Great Depression, where, you know, more than a third of Americans were out of work. I mean, I don't think let's hope that we don't have a Great Depression again. And people aren't talking about a Great Depression, things getting that bad. But also, the 1924 immigration legislation was what initially really cut off this immigration. So we can't forget laws. And if we look at U.S. immigration law, since 1965, and 65 was when the first major immigration law that really allowed that gave rise to some of the new immigration. It opened up the door and for mass Asian immigration. It opened up the door for many people from the Caribbean. That subsequent to that, actually every single piece of legislation has actually expanded the number of legal immigrants who've been allowed to come in. So actually, we've been expansive in our immigration policy in many ways. Although, obviously, the demand is still greater than the numbers that are legally permitted to come in. And even in the last, there hasn't been discussion. I mean, the discussion is all about, in terms of legislation, is all about undocumented immigrants and whether there should be a pathway to legalization. It hasn't been about cutting back the numbers of legal immigrants. So that hasn't happened. It doesn't mean that it won't happen, but the United States allows in a large number, what the flow is very large, of legal immigrants. And so I would suspect that would still continue. Of course, I could be wrong. But, you know, I think in the certainly immediate future, I don't see that being cut back.
We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. They're both in Urbana. So we'll start with line number one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Mm-hmm. I was interested. My mother's parents were from Finland and they lived in Wisconsin, then moved to Colorado. She was born there. But we were talking about modern, a lot of this modern immigration stems from the social failures of the countries of the immigrants originate from. Like Mexico is basically an autocracy with, you know, a very elite group of people, 2 or 3% that own pretty much 90% of everything. So their outlet is the United States and probably lower wage jobs and stuff like that. And so how do you feel about that? I mean, in the sense that a lot of the Mexicans here send money back, according to the New York Times in our article, I think you mentioned it earlier, about the remittances were much less, and it's like 30% of the Mexican economy. I don't know how much it is in, Central America, Mesoamerica, Guatemala, places like that. But and you're talking about legal immigration, allowing engineers from Asia to come here and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But do you feel that a lot of this resentment now stems from the fact that there's a really large social welfare apparatus which doesn't deny health care and certain, you know, even to illegal immigrants, and people feel like they're paying for it, versus in the early 20th century, there's nothing like that. So you were sort of came here and you were on your own, more or less, you know, as a social, let's say the society didn't have to pay for you if you got sick, you just died. So is there something to that, do you think?
Well, you mentioned a bunch of different things. I guess I could start at the and that our country actually isn't all that generous when it comes to social welfare benefits for immigrants. We don't very undocumented immigrants are eligible for very little. They're only eligible for emergency Medicaid. or for what contagious diseases. They children have the right to go to public school, but aside from that, there's pretty much nothing. I mean, they're not eligible for benefits. Moreover, after the 1996 Act, many legal immigrants, until they become citizens, aren't eligible for many benefits. Depends on, you know, the states have stepped in some way, some of the states, but no, I mean, I think actually we're pretty... We're not very generous, and a lot of our benefits aren't that generous anyway. I mean, if you look at, compare, for example, to Europe, where immigrants, legal immigrants, are eligible for practically everything that native-born citizens are eligible for. We make a difference between citizens and legal immigrants. So, and remember, immigrants, including, I mean, here we have a situation with illegal immigrants. Say, many of them pay taxes. You know, they're paying taxes, and they pay taxes both in terms of, you know, to the government, you know, every year. If they don't have a Social Security number, they can get these special numbers and pay taxes that way. Many of them do because they hope that ultimately there may be a legalization program and they can show residence that way. But, you know, every time they buy anything, they're paying a tax with sales taxes. So, you know, they actually are putting in money, and they're also, not only that, they're doing jobs that many Americans won't do. And, you know, they're not really getting any benefits for it, you know, unless they need emergency medical care. So, you know, I don't think they're sapping our wealth, you know, our social, our limited social welfare system. In terms of the remit, you know, the foreign aid and sending money back, in a way, you can look at it as foreign aid that, you know, it's a kind of foreign aid that America is giving to help, you know, Mexico and certainly many Latin American and Caribbean countries, and probably to help keep them stable. Without that, they would be, you know, much more unrest there. So actually, it's in our interest, I think, in many ways, to have these remittances being sent back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find that interesting, though, that you would say that, because, I mean, is it like they come here, and that's, I'm not, you know, I don't really know many of them, but I just find it interesting that there seems to be no movement on the government's part to ask the question, well, why is everything so screwed up down there? I mean, these economies are,
they
support their people. I mean, I know in Guatemala and in Honduras we had kill squads and all the CIA and all that from the 60s and 70s and the 50s even. But, I mean, it seems to me like, why don't they straighten their... The elite down there fairly well.
It's much more complicated than that, and it's the nature of these economies and whoever.
Yeah, I mean, well, how?
I mean, I think the United States actually would like to have Mexico have a stronger economy, because they would actually, one argument is if Mexico has a stronger economy, they would send fewer immigrants here. They'd have fewer undocumented immigrants here. So, but, you know, I think that's a very complicated question. I think I don't want to get the whole issue of development of Latin America and the Caribbean.
Well, I mean, the development has been hampered.
Well, because these are countries that have been economically underdeveloped for a very long time, and their economies have been suffering.
Yeah, but I mean, these people, I know they live in poverty, have been down to these places and stuff, but the thing is that, I mean, we're talking 50, 60, we're going to be dead by 50 years from now. Will somebody be talking about it 50 years from now saying, well, why aren't they fixed? I mean, it seems to me that there's all these academics, like economic, you know, academics here, and they bring people up here with Spanish speaking and they train them and they go back, and then what, do they come back here and teach? I mean, I don't quite understand why. I mean, why is it taking so long? I mean, these people have no school systems, or they have minimal school systems. I mean, how many years are we going to talk here? 100?
Well, I think that's really a different issue that I don't want to go into. But I do, for the general audience, would like to emphasize, because I think another fact about the current immigration is that people have an idea that it's all people who are poorly educated, who are, you know, flocking to the United States. And it is true that about a third of the immigrants in the United States have very low levels of education, less than a high school education. But over a quarter of the immigrants, adult immigrants in the United States, have a college degree or more. We're also, and there are a lot of immigrants who are coming here who are highly educated and highly skilled. So, I mean, that's something that also, you know, needs to be borne in mind.
I hope the call will forgive me if I go on. We've got some other callers also in Urbana. So next, let's go to line number two. Hello.
Hi. I'm calling because earlier in the conversation, there was a mention of this concept of commitment to America, and I'm not accusing you of espousing that, but it strikes me as a very strange and abstract concept. I don't really understand what that means. I mean, I can understand commitment to my family, my community, my job, that kind of stuff. But I don't understand what it is to be committed to America. You know, does it mean I have to, you know, say the Pledge of Allegiance every day? Do I have to buy stocks? I wonder if you could explain what that, you know, what do people think that means, and how is somebody expected to, you know, express their commitment to America?
I think that's a very good question. After all, most America, I mean, what do we, well, I don't really, you know, it's a phrase that is bandied about. You're absolutely right. I think, you know, partly it's, I guess, feeling part of America, and I think also it's actions. I mean, in terms of if you're a citizen, voting, for example, becoming involved in life here, buying homes, settling, you know, getting involved in organizations here. I mean, those are the various measures that sociologists look when they look at, you know, they call it civic incorporation. But you're right. I mean, it's a very nebulous concept. And, you know, why do we in some ways expect immigrants to have so much commitment to America, right?
Okay, well, thanks.
All right, thank you. And again, we'll go to another caller. This is also someone in Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
It seems to me you've raised an interesting question about level of education among immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
Often it seems that the feeling here is that everybody that's coming over is uneducated and mm-hmm. unable to take care of themselves. Actually, a very large portion of the immigrants are highly qualified, and it seems a much more important problem is that we seem to be skimming off the educated elite from third world nations and retarding their development.
Well, that's an issue for some countries. You're right. I mean, one of the areas that I did work in earlier in my career was the Caribbean and Jamaica, and that's a terrible problem for them. I mean, they lose nurses. You know, they educate. In fact, it's a terrible problem. They lose a lot of healthcare professionals. You know, so this is a problem for them. You know, they try to make requirements that if they pay for education, you have to work in the country for a certain number of years. But as soon as that's over, people hightail it to the United States because they can make so much more money here. So, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It is a problem for many countries that they're losing highly skilled professionals that they need. And the United States, of course, gains. I think one of the things about it also is I'm coming at this often from a New York perspective, which is where I live and I do my work. But I think in New York, people aren't often aware of it because, of course, even though people come here highly skilled and professional, they don't always have those jobs here. Nurses are actually a case, not a good example of that, because if they're qualified nurses in the Caribbean, for example, they can usually work here. But many professionals they need to meet American licensing requirements. They don't speak English, and so this is actually a great gain for America, is that, you know, you have these immigrants who are doing lower level jobs who are highly overqualified for them, you know, and who would never in the world, you know, in their home country do these jobs. So we have, you know, this amazing, you know, highly qualified workforce here of immigrants. And also, of course, we cream off not only those with high skill levels from many of these countries, but those who emigrate are usually the most, you know, have drive and ambition. That's, you know, sort of an old cliche about immigration, but I think it's probably largely true. So we are getting, you know, this is a problem. On the other hand, as I was also talking about earlier, I mean, there's the remittance issue. These countries need the money.
No, I'm on the phone.
Okay. Go ahead, Ms. Bunner, go ahead.
So, I mean, on the other side of the coin is the remittances, you know, that are coming in from abroad, including from the professionals. So, you know, I think that's that, you know, but you raise an important point.
We just have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Again, our guest is Nancy Foner. She is a distinguished professor of sociology at Hunter College and the Graduate Center, City University of New York, has done a lot of work on immigration and particularly looking at what are the differences, the similarities between the immigrants of the last, particularly of the last big wave, comparing those folks with people who come to the United States today. And again, questions are welcome. Well, going back to that very point, and again, I suppose I'm thinking about the the talk that you're going to give, what's new about the new immigrants. One thing, as you have discussed earlier, one thing that is new is the places that people are coming from. So that's a difference. Another difference might be, as you explained, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, there wasn't that much in the way of hurdles for you to jump over to get in. I guess as long as you could demonstrate you didn't have any communicable diseases, they pretty much would let you in. In what other ways, though, are there some other, you think, significant ways that today's immigrants are, in fact, different from those of that last wave?
Well, where they're going, I guess, is another difference, because you say, where are they coming from? I've talked about their backgrounds. You know, they're more highly educated today than they were in the past. Where they're going, partly it's because America is so different. When immigrants came 100 years ago, they mainly went to the Northeast and the Midwest, which, of course, is not surprising, because that's where most people in America lived then. Today, they're going to the Southwest, to the West, to the South. California, Texas, and Florida have large, large immigrant populations. Although we should bear in mind that still immigrants are fairly concentrated in a number of states. Illinois, by the way, being one of the states that receives the most immigrants. The largest is California, followed by New York, then Florida, Texas, New Jersey, and Illinois. But what's happened today, maybe it's worth talking a little bit about this for just a couple of minutes, is this spread of immigration today to what sociologists refer to as, quote, new destinations or non-traditional destinations. And that's a phenomenon of really the last decade or so, is that large numbers are moving away or not moving to the major gateways like New York and Los Angeles. And New York and Los Angeles are the major gateways in the United States. And moving to places in the South, places in the Midwest that have not seen immigration for a very long time, and in some places in the South have almost never seen immigration. And so this is a phenomenon, a very recent phenomenon, and one that is beginning to be studied. Yeah. So in terms of where they live, another difference is I think that many immigrants today are moving to the suburbs right away, and that didn't happen in the past. I think that, of course, our economy is very different, so that you have immigrants not going to work in factories. Some do go to work in factories, but, of course, many in service jobs. One of the things that I write about also is that we haven't discussed is ties to the home country. We've only discussed that in terms of sending money home. And one argument that I make is, and I say, well, and it's called in the literature, social scientists refer to transnationalism or transnational ties across borders between immigrants here and into their home country. And you know, one of the arguments that I've made is, well, it's not something new. Immigrants in the past sent letters home. They sent money home. They went to visit sometimes. In the case of Italians, they went back and forth. They kept up and read about news in their home country. They gave money to political causes. So it wasn't that they just came here and cut off ties. But there is something new about transnational ties today that makes living in America and being an immigrant today quite different. And I think it has an awful lot to do with modern technology. You can get on a plane and be back in your home country, in a few hours, in a way that you obviously couldn't. It took a long time for a letter to get back to Italy and then for the person to write to you back today. There are cell phones. I think one of the, in my own experience, perhaps, brings it out. In the late 1960s, I did field work in a Jamaican village. I mean, this is even a change from the 1960s. And there was no phone in the community. The only way that you could get a message was by a telegram, and the village postmistress, read them all. And then as I was about to leave the community, there was one phone that came in, and that was in the center of the community. And, some people live like 5 miles away from it. You had to make an appointment with someone in New York if they were going to call you, and there were long lines at this phone. Then private phones came in, and some of the better off could have them. This all leads up to the present, in which there are about a little under 3 million people in Jamaica, which, by the way, sends enormous numbers of immigrants to the United States. And there are 2.1 million cell phones in Jamaica. So you know, virtually everyone has a cell phone. Mm. And, you know, with these cheap plans, you know, people are just, and they all have relatives in the United States. Everybody in Jamaica has a relative in the United States, many of them in New York, some others in Florida. And, you know, they're out in the fields, you know, calling their relatives. They're calling several times a day. That really does make the immigrant experience quite different. There's TV. When I was visiting Jamaica, I was looking at TV, and it wasn't just that I was seeing CNN. I was seeing local news in New York about traffic patterns on the Long Island Expressway. So I think, you know, people there are aware of things here in a way they weren't before, and people, the ties are kept up. Also, you know, the issue we haven't talked about, which is an issue for some people, dual citizenship. Many countries, what's the big change is that many countries that send immigrants to the United States now allow their citizens to maintain citizenship, even if they become U.S. citizens. In some cases, they can even vote in home country elections from the United States. The evidence shows there's been a concern among some people that this is diluting, not to use that word, commitment, or let's say involvement and allegiance to the United States when they become U.S. citizens. But the evidence that we have so far seems to suggest that those who are vote in their home country are also likely to vote here. Those who are politically involved in home country politics are actually more likely to be involved in politics here, so it seems to reinforce each other, not to detract from participation in the United States. So I don't know. Those are just some of the differences.
Well, I think that's very interesting, and it does, I think, go back to the very point that the caller raised this question. Mm-hmm. Well, what do we mean by commitment to the mm-hmm. country? And I'm sure I use that as well. Maybe not so much on my own account, but because that is the kind of thing that people, the kind of language that people use, and this is, I'm sure, something that is pointed to. And again, refers back perhaps to the myth of the earlier wave, mm-hmm. and that people do have this idea that while one maybe felt fondly about the old country, mm-hmm. that there was more of a break, and mm-hmm. that now, because communication is easier and travel is easier, that we have people who have some kind of a dual identity, mm-hmm. and that it wasn't quite so much the case right. in the past. And I'm not sure that that's really true.
Well, it's one question is whether it's true, and the other issue is whether, you know, one takes away from the other. I think, you know, you can have two identities. You can be involved in two countries at the same time. I mean, it's not... I mean, another concern, by the way, you know, I don't think it's an all or nothing, you know, it's one or the other. In fact, they can reinforce each other. And if you're living here most of the time, you're bound to become involved in life here in many ways. I mean, I think it's, you know, inevitable. I guess there are two points that I wanted to make. I mm-hmm. hope we have time. One is this
sure.
issue, if we're talking about commitment, is citizenship. And as I said before, there were great concerns in the past that the immigrants would not become citizens. Now, you know, in fact, one of the things that's happened is people are becoming citizens at more rapid pace these days lately. I mean, there's been a rise in citizenship applications, even though it's become more expensive here. You know, so I think that's the case. The other issue, if we're talking about assimilation, I think another issue that just to emphasize, you know, immigrants who come from another country and here to come to the United States are bound to maintain ties and allegiances in many ways to their home country, often to speak the language, maintain cultures, although obviously it changes in the United States. But if we're really talking about full kind of assimilation into American society, we're talking about the children of immigrants. And all of the evidence points out that the children of immigrants are becoming, quote, American, just as the children of immigrants did in the past. We don't have time to discuss this now because I see the time is running out. But at the talk, I mean, because another big issue in studies of immigrants today is, you know, how are the children of immigrants doing? And I can just say very briefly that the evidence, and we have growing, you know, a number of studies on this, are showing that the second generation, the children of immigrants born in the United States, are actually doing, they're doing better than their parents. They're not making, most of them are not making great leaps forward, but that didn't happen in the past either. Just as in the past, they are doing somewhat better than their parents, becoming hyphenated Americans, I guess, in many cases. But many of the patterns are very similar to what we saw in the past.
We have maybe about a minute. I guess as a final question, do you think that this is going to continue to be as contentious an issue in the next few years, at least, as it is right now?
Yes, I think so. I think it will. I think because, well, partly I think once the election happens and whoever gets into office, I think once again the issue of what to do about the undocumented is going to be put on the legislative table. It's not in, recently it's been, you know, it's not really been part of the political campaigns for various reasons. The candidates don't really want to talk about it, but I think that's going to come up again. So that issue in terms of what to do politically will come up. And the other issue is how is the declines in the economy going to affect this? The question is, will there be resentments of immigrants if their jobs are scarcer? That's another possibility. You know, so that could also raise questions. But remember, at the same time, we've got 38 million immigrants in the United States. We have almost as many children of immigrants who are becoming Americans. So they're becoming a growing part of American society, and that, maybe to leave on this notion, it's not just that immigrants are assimilating into America, but immigrants and their children are changing America, and that's all becoming part of what we know as, you know, American, really. So that's another, I think that's an important point that we haven't had time to really emphasize, but I think it's one that's perhaps a good way to end, that it's not just that America changes immigrants, but immigrants throughout history, as they are doing today, are also changing America.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Nancy Foner. She's a sociologist at Hunter College and the Graduate Center, City University of New York. She'll be visiting the campus of the University of Illinois next week. She'll be giving a talk on Tuesday, the 7th, 4 in the afternoon, at Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum, on talking on the subject, What is New About the New Immigrants? This is part of an initiative of the Center for Advanced Study looking at history and policy of immigration. Professor Foner, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.